Welcome to Sci-Fi on Screen, the podcast that goes where no podcast has gone before. We here at Sci-Fi on Screen take a deep, close look at your favorite genre movies of science fiction, horror, fantasy, and comic book land. We go deep, scene by scene. We do comparisons of originals and remakes, and special shows. Just ahead, a new episode. And thanks for listening. Welcome back to another episode. This week, I'm going to be taking a look at I Am Legend franchise and talking a bit about the Richard Matheson novel, the three major film adaptations, Last Man on Earth, I Am Legend, and The Omega Man, just comparing and contrasting to each other and to the book. Before we get into that, I want to do a brief feedback. I want to thank Glenn Ackland. He had a comment about some of the prequel stuff that I've done. He wrote, quote, "I really enjoyed the prequel Star Wars. I laughed when you spoke about Temuera Morrison because I am a Kiwi and went to see the Attack of the Clones in the theater. We all laughed when it got to the Jango Fett scene, but I'm glad some people out there enjoyed it," unquote. Thanks, Glenn, for writing. And it's always funny, you know, it's always great to hear from different places in the world how they're taking in culture. I know that in Japan, like, you know, Star Trek is like the Adventures of Captain Sulu, you know, like it's a whole different kind of ball game. So I kind of like getting those angles from different people around the world. So thanks to Glenn. And I want to thank Matt Hurt and Hedgenite84 for retweeting my Star Trek V The Voyage Home podcast. Appreciate it, guys. And I want to just thank everyone who's been clicking on the links at the bottom of each podcast on the webpage that take you to Amazon. I got a nice year-end present where Amazon let me know that they were going to transfer a couple of dollars into my bank account. That comes from you guys clicking on or possibly purchasing the Blu-ray versions of stuff that I've recorded. So thanks to everyone who's done that. I really, really appreciate it. The stats took like 3 months to accumulate, so I didn't know that it was even being, anyone was clicking on it, but Amazon seems to think so. So it was a nice chunk of money, and it was, you know, a nice present at year end. So thank you so much for everyone for doing that. All right, so let's get into stuff. I apologize a little bit for my voice. It's a little raspy. It's New Year's Day, and I was reveling a bit last night, so I've got a little rasp in my voice. Hope it's not too terrible. I want to start off talking about the novel I Am Legend, published by Richard Matheson in 1954. I went back and reread it, not too deeply, but just, you know, skimmed a lot of it, but read some of it for preparation for this podcast because it is the inspiration for so many things. George Romero, you know, cites Last Man on Earth and the novel for inspiring Night of the Living Dead. And I feel like so much has come out of this story, you know, three films plus, you know, Romero's franchise and, you know, countless other copies and knockoffs, that I thought I would just take a look at the novel. It was very interesting. And the first thing, before I get into the plot of the novel, the one thing that really, really struck me was I really was able to see the genesis of Stephen King's work, the way he writes, and, you know, how, especially his short work, his short stories. And I know that he's done some forewords to some of Matheson's collections, so I know he's a huge fan. This is really, it really struck me reading I Am Legend, like how King-like it was. And obviously, you know, he came first, so it's how Matheson-like King is really the deal. But it was kind of cool to see that, you know, I know King cites Lovecraft, and he likes, I think, Donald Westlake, you know, some thriller writers in the 60s. But Matheson, boy, it's a real, I mean, he really must have read and, you know, really studied and consumed lots of Matheson because it's very, very similar. So I thought that was interesting. Briefly, just to give you a plot of the novel, if many of you haven't read it, there's a nice plot outline over on Wikipedia, which pretty much takes you through the novel, but I'll just kind of give you a sketch here. The story kind of starts out with a gentleman by the name of Robert Neville, who's in his home, and it's his daily routine. Obviously, he's alone, and, you know, he's going about all these daily routines, and we, you know, we get a sense that there are, you know, I think what Matheson refers to them as vampires at this point. They're zombie-like, but he, you know, he refers to them as vampires. The beginning of the story here is that there was a nuclear war. This germ, which may or may not have been caused by the war, infected a lot of people, and it infects people, and then when they die, it spores and kind of is carried on winds and by mosquitoes to most of the population of the planet, which, you know, succumbs to this germ. And so we get this backstory about his wife. You know, the beginning of the book is sort of him going about his daily, the attacks every night on his house, and he goes out during the day to kill. And then we get a flashback about his wife, who he was forced to kill, who had the germ. Neville is immune in the story. He doesn't cure himself or take any vaccine. Like, he was just naturally immune. He suspects that it's because he was bitten by a vampire bat in South America at one point, that maybe that helped, you know, it's some notion of that being part of his immunity. And then, you know, the classic part of this novel is that they're burning all of the bodies because the plague is able to reanimate dead tissue. So you get people coming back from the dead. So they burn them, but he doesn't want to burn her. He buries her instead. And of course, at some point, she knocks on the door as a vampire and he like flips out. And then there's a long sequence about him coaxing a dog who's not been infected, so he thinks, to come into his house. And the dog is like so totally frightened of everybody. And it's just long series of chapters on little by little, he gets his dog to come into the house. And then eventually, when he examines the dog, as he has learned what to look for in terms of who is infected under the microscope, the dog dies of the infection. And then the third arc is this woman, Ruth, who he discovers as well, brings into the house. You know, she turns out to be a spy for a group of people who've been infected but have discovered sort of a type of drug that blocks it from manifesting to be completely mindless vampires. He goes out during the day as part of his routine, kills them all. He goes into their houses, wherever they're sleeping, and he stakes them and kills them. So he's been doing that for years, and he has eradicated a lot of them. He is quite a plague on the vampires during the day when they're sort of quiescent and they won't come out, you know, during the sunlight. So Ruth is sent in to kind of smoke him out because they can never get into his house. He's got it boarded up and he defends himself really well. Then this group of people who are taking sort of the preventative vaccine so the disease doesn't manifest finally come and attack him, and he's taken away to their sort of hideout. But she realizes that he's kind of a human being, and so much of what he did was because he didn't know better. So they're about to kind of crucify him in public, and she gives him these drugs to take, and we sort of, the novel ends with, you know, her putting the drugs in his hand and him being wheeled out into like this place of execution. And the cool part of it is that, talk about this a little bit later, but Matheson flips the notion of like, you know, what is the idea of like the folktale legend of a vampire, right? It's this creature that comes during the night and takes your baby, turns you into another vampire, all this stuff. So the flip is that Neville is the terrible legend because these creatures are going to take over the world. They're the new breed. Neville's the last human being on the planet. He was the only one immune to this thing. And when he dies, you know, this new sort of nation will rise, and, you know, he will go down in history as this legendary figure who used to come and terrorize people during the night. You know, he'll be the boogeyman for the vampire civilization, which is very clever. Really, really clever idea. And one thing I wanted to talk about is that there's a heavy science and science fiction element in I Am Legend. Like, it's not just a boogeyman book. You know, Neville goes to the library and he researches all this stuff. I think he's a chemist or a scientist in his regular life. And so he does all this research. He finds under a microscope exactly what the germ looks like. So he kind of isolates what is this bacteria that's causing all this behavior. And one of the cool things is he tries to figure out why the vampires don't like mirrors, shy away from crosses and garlic. His theory is that, you know, being driven insane by the disease, the infected now react as they believe they should act when confronted with these items, right? So there's a legend of vampires, and everyone knows that they're afraid of these specific things. And his thesis is that those beliefs stay in the brain even as the rest of their higher functions are sort of destroyed by the virus, and they become these just, you know, blood-hungry creatures. But these really deep-seated beliefs remain. Looking in a mirror doesn't actually do anything to them. Smelling garlic doesn't actually do anything to them. But the beliefs are so ingrained that it's actually part of their autonomic responses, which I think is just like the coolest thing, you know? Like, I didn't expect it coming from this novel. And that, in terms of them fearing iconography, like a Christian vampire would fear the cross, but a Jewish vampire would not. And a Muslim vampire would not. So it would be endemic to, you know, the person's faith and their held beliefs, which is amazing. And there's also some talk about he's staking them. Then at some point, he realizes that he doesn't need to have a wood stake. Part of the virus is that the stake holds open sort of an orifice in the body, which allows air in. And when this bacterium is exposed to air, it becomes parasitic towards the vampires, which then eats them alive inside. If they're just punctured, part of the virus actually closes the holes over, the skin closes over very quickly, and which is just, you know, he thought all this through. It's really, really ingenious. All the stuff that's in there. Like, it's definitely just a, you know, kind of a Stephen King popish novel, like reminded me of his 70s novels, not very long, but chock full of cool ideas, you know, and not much character development. But anyway, so yeah, so it was really interesting reading the novel I Am Legend and realizing that Matheson had put a lot of thought into how this stuff might play out. And it's much less occultish horror than it is like sci-fi. So it was very cool. With that in mind, I went ahead and I screened the three major films that were made from this novel. The first one was done in 1964, about, you know, 10 years after the novel was released. It was called The Last Man on Earth. It was done in black and white by American International Pictures, which is sort of Roger Corman's group. It starred Vincent Price, and they changed the last name, so he's Dr. Robert Morgan in this, but he is a chemist and scientist. Then in 1971, it was remade as The Omega Man with Charlton Heston. Again, the name is back now to Neville, Robert Neville. And then in 2007, it was remade again with Will Smith, and this is the first time that they used the title of the novel, simply called I Am Legend. And again, he's Robert Neville, same character. There was, a direct-to-video movie called I Am Omega, which, you know, there's the whole direct-to-video phenomenon when major movies come out. These direct-to-video companies put together films that have similar artwork and names, and they pump them out, like, either right before or right after. So, you know, fooling. I don't know who they're fooling. It's bizarre. When the big Transformers movie came out, there was one called Transmorphers, you know, and I guess when I Am Legend came out, they pump one out called I Am Omega. I didn't watch it. I'm not going to even bother because I'm sure it's just completely dreadful. So purists out there who are keeping score with the adaptations, yes, I am technically missing one of them, but it looked like a piece of garbage, so I didn't even bother screening it. So what I'm going to do is just, you know, talk through different aspects of the story, because pretty much from beginning to end, the stories are similar. So I'm going to take chunks of the story and character and all that, and just kind of compare the three films with each other, see who's doing what in relation to the novel as well. Let's start with The Last Man on Earth, 1964. The film, first of all, is in black and white. Immediately reminded me of the opening of Night of the Living Dead, and Romero has stated explicitly that this film had inspired him. So kind of interesting to see. And we open with a montage of an empty city. And they're really beautiful, you know, very subdued soundtrack, if there's any sound, actually. Wonderful shots of large parts of the city, empty streets and parking lots, everything very still and empty. And then we slowly start to see bodies being strewn around, their bodies on steps, you know, bodies where bodies shouldn't be, basically. And the overall effect is very chilling and very stark. When we first started, I thought, holy shit, man, is this going to be like a lost gem that nobody talks about? Because it was a really hell of an opening. Before we get to the character, the camera pans up to a church billboard, and the church has, you know, put in the little sign holder, "The End Has Come." So that's how that one starts, and then, of course, our character starts, but I'll get to that. Now, we'll switch to Omega Man, 1971. Very similar, but this time we open right away with our main character driving down a deserted street in the city of Los Angeles, and I think it was filmed there as well. But not perfectly, though. If you watch the opening of Omega Man, you can see every once in a while like a single car way in the distance or like a person. But for the most part, it's really great. And it's kind of funny. He's the character's putting in an 8-track tape into the player, into the car. And I was just like, oh my God, 8-track tapes. It was really interesting. But the director here wonderfully like pulls back a lot in the early part of the movie. So, we're very close up on Charlton Heston, you know, driving around in his big car. And then the camera does this long pullback where it starts to go up and up and up and over the city. And we get a sense of just how alone and small he is in this massive city that we've seen nothing but emptiness. Again, very similar to The Last Man on Earth. Just, you know, lots of empty streets, empty parking lots. There are more things in the road. They've done a little bit more, you know, production design here. But it's really great. There's an armored car that's been, there's an attempted robbery. I guess there's bodies and money strewn all around. And, you know, of course, Neville takes a look at the money and laughs to himself. And the very last shot before we kind of get to any plot, you know, again, the camera pulls way, way up and he's walking alone. I think he runs out of gas at that point, so he has to walk. But he's walking by himself down the street in this abandoned city. And it's really good, like really solidly done. So now we'll switch to I Am Legend, 2007. I will say that I Am Legend is definitely the superior film over both of the, you know, the earlier films. And not so much because it's that much better written. Like, you know, it's pretty well written, but it's more because from 1971 to 2007, just the sheer amount of new cinematic techniques that were introduced into filmmaking. You know, like you look at films in the early 1950s up to like the late 1960s, and it's like, you know, they're not huge changes in terms of how action is shot, but you go from like 1970 to, you know, 2007, and, you know, the world changed after Jaws and Star Wars, and, you know, music videos were a huge part of it as well. So the cinematic language in 2007 is just so much richer. Post-THX Lucasfilm sound as well, sound design. So I'll probably gush a little bit more about I Am Legend, and it's largely because, you know, you're just getting the full cinematic impact of modern filmmaking. But it's also very well directed. So we open up with black screen, and we hear sports radio playing. Just, you know, two guys talking about, like, last night's scores. And then, at some point, the camera then goes into focus, and there's this news broadcast with the on the same news channel. They have a guest on to talk about this scientific advance. And it's the woman's name is Dr. Alice Crippen, and she's played uncredited by Emma Thompson. And so, you know, we basically hear in a very quick dialogue that they've engineered a measles virus to cure pretty much all forms of cancer. And they've had this, you know, I think they've treated like 10,003 people, and there are 10,003 success rates. And so the woman on the news says, "So you've cured cancer?" And Dr. Crippen smiles and says, "Yes, actually, yes, we have." And so then we cut to a title card that reads 3 years later. And now we're back into our empty cityscape like the first two films. But for the first time in these versions that we're really getting a cinematic impact that this is really an abandoned city. Whereas, you know, 1964 and 1971, we're just getting shots of empty cities. We don't see things that are overgrown or destroyed or different. In some of them, we see some cars laying around and some people laying around. But now we're in for it. You know, we see flooded, one of the eastern tunnels is flooded. Times Square is filled with grass. The sound design now is really intense, so we can hear the wind whistling around the city. And we don't hear any of the normal city sounds. And it looks amazing. The CGI is pretty seamless in us thinking that this is being shot around in a, you know, a 3 years no people in New York City. So very, very cool. Then we see a lone car, you know, driving down one of the streets, and we're introduced to Dr. Robert Neville and his dog. And Neville in this film was played by Will Smith. Great visuals of the overgrown city. And we see that some of the buildings have been covered with this plastic sort of, you know, biohazard tarp with emblems of it on it. And then we're in a hunt, and he's hunting deer, and a herd of deer explode on the screen. And Neville chases with his car and then on foot. And they end up in Times Square. We have a Steadicam with Neville. So, you know, it's really great. It really feels very immediate. You know, Neville finally comes upon the deer, and he's about to shoot it when this lion pride kind of enters in. And they take the deer down. And, you know, Neville does not kill the lions, recognizing like another species is fighting for survival, which is kind of interesting. And one funny note, this has been bandied around the internet for a while, but before we cut out of this sequence, the camera lingers on a billboard in Times Square with a Superman Batman logo. So, you know, they used to have Superman versus Batman was like in development hell for, you know, tons of years before they went with Nolan and Batman Begins. So this is the billboard that says Superman Batman May 2015. It's so funny because originally that was going to be the Batman v Superman release date. It was going to be May of 2015, and they pushed it up. So the film misses, you know, an accurate film release date by 1 year. You know, it was made in 2007, and you know, Batman v Superman: Dawn of Justice will now come out in May 2016. So I don't know, just kind of a fun little nerd factoid. Okay, so now I'm going to go back, and we're going to start talking about the introduction and the character development of the three leads. And I'll start with 1964's The Last Man on Earth. After the initial opening, we now see Robert Morgan in his house. great, actually, really good mise-en-scene, I think that is the term, where, you know, the people who come in and dress the sets, and great production design. So Vincent Price is walking around his house, and we see there are calendars on the wall that have been X'd out, and the place he lives in is a complete and utter mess. There's crap everywhere, most of it, you know, having to do with survival, you know, kinds of machines and foodstuffs. And in this film, we're getting a voiceover narration by Price. So he's not speaking in the screen, but we hear him voiceover. The year is 1968, and it's 3 years after the plague struck. One weird anachronistic thing is the music that they're using here is really bad. It's sort of like music from like a 1950s horror movie, and it does not, I mean, this should be subdued kind of eerie music or just, or, you know, very subtle music, and it's just ridiculously overdone. So they must have got it for free or something. So we see that, you know, he hangs wreaths of garlic around mirrors around the front of his house. There are vampire bodies strewn all around the front yard. We see in his garage, he's got generators, and, you know, he's gassing them up for another day running. He's got a big ham radio in his living room, and he's using that to try to raise people. The window on the front door is broken, so he really need, and he's out of them, so it's one of the things he needs to now get. And the pacing is great here. The film really takes its time. We hear Price narrating in voiceover as he's moving around the house, talking to himself about, you know, what he's got to do and, you know, how he's feeling. The map on this wall is sort of him, you know, trying to find out where the main clutch of vampires is hiding. So it's, you know, he goes out every night to stake and kill them. The map sort of is a way of him remembering where he's been, which is kind of cool. And so then we see him, he's got he's making stakes, which is kind of cool. So he's on a lathe, and we see that he's got, you know, this wood stack next to it, and he has to make dozens of new stakes every day because he uses them each night. I thought that was kind of neat. And again, you know, we hear him even speaking that the stakes have to be wide enough to keep their body seal from working, to expose their bodies to, you know, the air, which kills them. And so right away, you know, we're right with the novel here. This film pretty much sticks very close to the novel. I don't think it deviates much at all. Then we also see that every day he takes all the bodies in, you know, like a hearse. He's got like a station wagon, he calls it a hearse. And the government, before things had broken down, had created this massive burning pit, which is where they put all these bodies, because if he doesn't, either has to stake them all or, you know, he has to burn them, otherwise they'll come back to life. So he's throwing bodies down into the pit. So then at a supermarket, you know, he's rigged up a generator at a local supermarket, where there's a freezer unit, which keeps a lot of meat there, so he stocks up. He goes to a mirror shop to replace the mirror, and then he visits the homes looking for vampires to kill, and we see him staking them out. And one scene is actually very creepy. It's a young woman, and he kind of comes in the house with a stake in his hand, and she sees him, and there's a real sense of terror in her face, and he kills her. I mean, they do, all the staking is done off camera. There's no practical effects, really, in this movie. It's really cool. And then they do the rest of him staking all the vampires as a montage. So we realize that he's doing this for a while. And then back home at night, now the vampires, when they come out at night, they converge on his house. And he just sits home and gets drunk and listens to music. I think he listens to classical while they, you know, his house is all boarded up. And the vampires are pretty stupid. One of them is an old neighbor of his. So we hear outside the guy saying, "Morgan, come out, Morgan." And they walk around with these 2x4s kind of bashing the house, but to no effect. So he's very safe. So the next day, then we follow him as he heads to a cemetery, and he's set up this large chapel, and there's a coffin there with the body of his dead wife, Virginia. But he's stayed there for way too long. He's had some flashbacks, which I'll get to a little bit after these sequences. So it's a little too late, and he realizes he's been out too late, and so he's got to fight off some vampires to get to his car. And it's really lame. Like, any of the action sequences in this film are really terrible. They're just not well well done at all. And obviously, it's the times. It's 1960s, but they're really goofy. And when he gets back to his house, they're already there. So he's kind of blocked from getting in. But he gets out of the car and uses a mirror to kind of fend them off so he can get to his front door. And, you know, whoever he shows the mirror to cowers back. And it's very cheesy. And then inside, the next day, he's watching home movies of his wife and child. And he breaks down. And Price, so far, is really good. I don't think Vincent Price is actually a very good actor, but he can do sort of self-pity. Like, you really pity this guy right now. And knowing what you know from the flashbacks to come about what happened to his wife and his child, like, you know, you really have sympathy for, I got to give it to Price, that you have sympathy for the character here, and you really pity the poor guy. And the movie gives us plenty of time to see what, you know, what he's like. Okay, so now let's shift to the Omega Man, and we're picking up with Robert Neville after he has crashed his car and has been, you know, we've seen him walking down a lonely street. He goes to a used car lot and picks out a new ride for himself. And in this film, Heston talks out loud, so he's monologuing on screen. He's kind of having both sides of conversations, trying to keep himself from going crazy. He picks a car and drives it out the window. And in this film, he's rigged a generator in a local movie theater. So he goes, I don't know if it's every day, but the last film that was playing in this theater was Woodstock, which, if anyone knows, is a concert film, I think released in 68 or 69. And so he sits in the theater by himself. He goes into the booth and he starts up the projector and, you know, he starts up the generator and he sits and watches the whole movie and he knows all the lines too. We get a bit of the Woodstock film as well. Like the film gives clips of Woodstock pretty much straight on the screen, you know, and I think it's part of the film's theme, because there is a theme in this one in terms of, what a civilization has gone and what was lost and, you know, the threat of what could be. So but I think it's kind of a subtle beginning of the theme here, and that, you know, the ethos of Woodstock is love, you know, and togetherness, and men and women and of all races and creeds coming together out of love and to kind of turn against the rampant commercial consumerism and militarism of their forebears. And, you know, it was the era when they just tried to do shit differently. It didn't turn out, you know, the way they really wanted it, but it was a hell of a decade. The last great, probably moral examination of our culture that's not based in a religion that was ever done in this country. So pretty astounding if you think about it. So I like that it's in the film too, because it's going to be part of the theme. So he also, again, like the first film, he walks out and the sun's really close to setting. He has spent too much time in the theater. And all of a sudden we hear hundreds of phones ringing all around. It's a really weird scene. And then he tells himself out loud, you know, there is no phone ringing. And they all stop. It's a really cool, stark moment that he's kind of losing it. He's been alone for 3 years, and, you know, he's not in the best mental state. So he gets home also a bit late. He opens the garage door to his house, and the vampires in this one are not really vampires. They're basically black-cloaked plague victims, and they all wear these same black cloaks, and they're referred to as the family. They're kind of like this medieval movement, as it were, which I'll get more into as I go. So he's got to battle some of them. They're coming at him with torches. One of them was waiting with gasoline, so they pour it, you know, try to get him with pouring gas on him and lighting him on fire, and he kind of evades them. And he's got a machine gun, and he's, you know, gunning them down left and right. Finally, you know, gets in, has the generator, the lights come on, and, you know, he's living in this beautiful townhouse. He's got a working fountain in front. And once the power goes on, all the lights come on, and, you know, the family have to move back. You know, like they can't get, they're very, very sensitive to light. And then we get some time with him inside his house. He's got a bust of Julius Caesar across from a chessboard, and he's talking to it as if it's his roommate. He's in incredible armory of all kinds of weapons. He's got a very sophisticated camera system that keeps track of, you know, the townhouse. He looks out the window and watches as more of the black-cloaked figures kind of burn and loot stuff nearby. They're systematically trying to reduce, you know, the civilization to rubble by destroying, you know, machines. They're different than the last man on Earth. They're actually very intelligent, and they're calling him Neville, so they know him. They're burning books and artwork specifically. The leader is a guy named Matthias, played by 70s and kind of 80s character actor Anthony Zerbe, who I really like. And Zachary, his lieutenant, and they're very intelligent. And they all wear sunglasses, which looks a bit goofy. The zombies in Omega Man are really goofy. You know, they wear all these black cloaks, and they have really bad makeup done as their plague, you know, scars on their face. They're white. They all wear sunglasses because their eyes are, when they take the glasses off, the eyes are really weird, like they're all bleached of color, and they're completely sensitive to light. But they look kind of goofy, unfortunately. There was something really good in this film, but I think every time you see the family, you're just like, oh, that's funny. You know, black-cloaked figures running around with torches. They're very much about, you know, taking Neville out and how they're going to do it. And inside, you know, at the same time, Neville's watching old news tapes, and we see a little bit of the tapes that he's got, a civilization breaking down, reports of plague victims, a little bit of a flashback, you know, a montage of dead civilians in their cars and their homes. Then we cut to the family. They have these catapults, and they load these flaming missiles and balls at him. He basically fires back with his machine gun, and they scatter. So they're completely outmatched in terms of technology with Neville, but very smart. So yeah, so let's skip up to I Am Legend as we get kind of our character introduction. After his day out hunting, we see that he uses these bottles of vinegar that he sort of squirts over his tracks when he goes into his house, because, you know, we get the sense that the We haven't seen anything yet of what his enemies are, but you know that possible that they could sniff him out if he didn't do that. This apartment too is really terrific. Just really good scene work. The set is great. It's just overstocked with all kinds of food, and we can see it all. There's a lot of great subtle touches. When he opens the refrigerator, the camera's looking at him from the side. When the fridge opens, we see straight on a copy of Life magazine with him on the cover, as him, like the last medical researcher. You know, can he come up with a solution to the plague? Quick way to kind of get a sense of who he is. He's got a very sophisticated series of doors and grates that lock his place down, and then him and his dog sort of cower in a bathtub, and this horrible, horrible sound rises from outside as some sort of creature we haven't seen yet is out and about. The sound is just not something that he's ever gotten used to, so it's cute that he's got this dog and they cower down in the bathtub for the night. The next day, we see him in a basement laboratory. He's got a very sophisticated set of cages and lab works down there. He has a whole complex of zombie rats that have all been turned into. And so we finally get a sense of what the virus does in this film, and it turns them into these incredibly powerful, and you know, it denuded them of hair, and they're very powerful, and the aggression level's off the charts, and they're all kind of, once he pulls the black cloak away and exposes them, they all go berserk. You know, he does some tests, checks some things out. He realizes that, there's one serum that may possibly work on humans, so he has to step it up to human trials. He's very, he's very regimented in all the things that he does. So now he does a little bit of a foray outside. He goes into a video store, and he set up all of these mannequins in the store to make it look like there are people browsing for videos. Which is great. He talks out loud as well. So he monologues out loud when he's in there, and he says hello to certain mannequins and he calls them by name. They also, like the 1964 film, and I don't think Heston did it, but 64 film with the maps. So he's got a very sophisticated map system to mark where he's been. He goes in to basically find supplies. He goes in to loot things. And part of his daily routine is he goes to South Street Seaport at noon and he broadcasts to anyone who can hear that he's there, and if anyone wants food and protection and shelter, and they're in New York City, to meet him there at that time. So that's a setup for something that's going to happen later. And while he's there, we get beautiful shots of the Brooklyn and Manhattan bridges, which were destroyed, and we don't know how, but we see that they are completely blown apart. Each side is still up, but the middle spans are gone. Now, there's more deer hunting. As part of this hunt, Neville's dog runs into a darkened building. And this is the first little scene that we're going to get with what's called the Dark Seekers in this film. And it's an astonishingly good sequence. It's a lot of handheld Steadicam shots as well. So he's got to take his time and follow, because Samantha is the dog's name, and he's so attached to it that he can't, so he's scared shitless. And with a flashlight and a rifle, he slowly makes his way into the bowels of this building looking for his dog. I've seen this movie multiple times, and every time I see the sequence, I'm still biting my nails. And we come upon what's called the Dark Seekers briefly. And the director's great because we only see them when Neville takes his hand away from the flashlight. And there's like a group of like 8 or 9 of them standing around, breathing extremely fast, but not doing anything else. And the camera cuts around them, and we see little bits of them, and it's really, really scary. And then when he finds his dog, there is one of those Dark Seekers there. It roars and leaps at Neville in a way that really is very terrifying. He kills it, and then, him and the dog are running out of there. And now the whole group of Dark Seekers is after them. And so once he's out in the sunlight, one of them, which we'll come to know as sort of the leader, actually forcibly sticks his face out into the sunlight as long as he can stand it, and then he pulls it in because it's burning. So it's one sense of like that there is some rudimentary intelligence going on here. However, he realizes since he's found them that he needs one for his experiment, so he sets a trap for them, and he uses a vial of his own blood, breaks it. It's like a bear trap, but it's kind of cool where he uses a rusted-out vehicle that when the trap is sprung, the vehicle drops, and it pulls the Dark Seeker out into the light, but he's rigged up like a black cloak around it so it doesn't die. It's really very well thought out, actually. And so he brings it back to the lab, and it's a female, and we see it on the table, and it's, again, it's breathing. I think it's like got a 220 beats per minute heart rate, and we get very close to it, and there's a big deal about that's made about this film and that the CGI looks fake, and It doesn't look the best, but I don't mind it because the film is so well made, and we're very close up on this female Darkseeker right now. To me, yeah, it's a little CGI-y, but they're also a weird new species, so we don't know how they're supposed to look, so I kind of buy it. He tries the compound that worked on the rat on her. It works for like a second, and then she comes back to full strength and flips out, and he's got to sedate her. And then we get some lip service to, there are two strains of the virus in this world. There's an airborne strain, a contact strain. Neville's immune to both of them, and the dog is immune to the airborne virus, which is going to set up what happens to it later, but not the direct contact virus. Just a brief kind of, you know, talking about the three actors here. Price is very good with what he does and so far, up till now. You really get a sense of self-pity for him. I like him. He's a good presence on screen. He's a big guy. Heston is terrific, and I'm biased because I'm a big Chuck Heston fan. But he's great. He's kind of talking to himself, and you know, he's kind of world weary. Like you can sense with Heston that he's just so tired of all his own shit. He's tired of his daily grind, and he's very cynical and jaded about everything, and that comes through really well. Will Smith is also terrific in a different way. You know, he's sort of a man living alone, very, very focused, incredibly slaved to a routine. Like we see him running in the morning. You know, there's several things that he does. He's very, very routine oriented. And we don't know much about him yet. His character gets more interesting as the film goes on. But up till now, you know, he's just a very focused guy who's extremely capable. And dedicated to finding a cure. Smith is great. Like, I think all three actors are really good. I think Heston and Smith are a little better than Vincent Price, especially later on. Price kind of loses it. But so far, like, at this point in each movie, like, we've got three really strong leads. Now, I'm going to talk a little bit about each of these films has a pre-plague flashback sequence that the three leads get into. Last Man on Earth probably has the most protracted one, and you know, we get a lot of information as he flashes back. And we see that Robert Neville is a scientist. He works with, I think, this guy Ben Cortman, who's like his lab partner at a lab. I don't think there's any military involvement, right? He's just a straight up chemist. In The Last Man on Earth, we hear that the plague started in Europe, that swept the world, and that it cannot be destroyed. From what we're told, they can't find a cure for it. Then we slowly see his wife and daughter get sick with the plague, but he does not. We're flashed back to the lab with his partner Cortman. We hear about bodies on the streets. They talk about the pit where they're burning the bodies. You know, rumors of the dead returning to life. That infected people can't stand sunlight and that they're very tired during the day. And we start to see like emergency programming on television, and bodies are being taken out of homes, and you know, loved ones are running out screaming. It's pretty good. You know, in terms of like a 50s sci-fi movie, it's pretty decently done. You know, that aspect of it is pretty solid. Now his partner Ben all of a sudden stays home, you know, because Morgan goes to his house and is like, you know, we've got to fight this thing. And Ben's like, to hell with it. The world's going apart. And so, you know, that's the last he sees of him alive, you know, as a regular person. He becomes a zombie. Morgan's sort of pretty much the last one at his lab. And, you know, he goes in day after day and no one's left. City is slowly emptying out. He gets home one day. The army has taken away his daughter, who's died of plague, and they're going to burn her. You know, he goes to the fire pit to try to get her back, but they have thrown her in the pit. And we see at the fire pit all these citizens wanting their loved ones and the military keeping them back and you know, needing to burn them. And we watch this small body being thrown on the fire, and it's very affecting, actually. But when his wife dies, he doesn't tell the military or anyone else. He winds up burying her. We do see in the flashback that one night she comes back, knocks on the door, and it's her. Then in The Omega Man, we have, you know, Heston is very much a military man. We see that he's a military doctor as well. And at one point, it's a very quick flashback, Neville's in a chopper with the last batch of vaccines that they have created before things start breaking down. And during the flight, both he and the pilot start to succumb to the virus, and they're like choking, and the pilot succumbs first, and the helicopter crashes. And Heston is hurt, but he's alive, and he drags himself to sort of a case, and he injects himself with the untested vaccine, but it works. So he becomes, you know, he was not immune to the original virus, but the last vaccine they were able to come up with works in him, and there's none left for anyone else. It was the only little bit. And so now he's the only inoculated person against, it killed the virus. And then, again, some flashbacks of some military attacks. And Matthias, who's the leader of the family, was the main news commentator. So we see Anthony Zerbe as his old job as a news commentator. We are told that a war that flared up between China and Russia, that the bacteria, the virus that's causing all this stuff, was an actual weapon of mass destruction by one of those powers. When those powers were kind of starting to go completely decimate each other, some of the missiles started landing in the U.S. and the bacilli was delivered there. And so this was a weapon created in a lab, which then was used in another part of the world and eventually spread to the entire world. From that flashback, now we know that Neville is really the only man who's immune. I Am Legend, they're very brief flashbacks, and it's all part of one long scene where Robert Neville has his wife and his child, his young daughter, and he's trying to get them off near Manhattan Island because it's been quarantined, and within a half hour, they're going to actually seal off the island because at some point, I guess, we're hearing that the vaccine is, things are becoming out of control there. So him being pretty high up, he's Colonel, I believe. It's Colonel Robert Neville. So he's pretty high up in the corporation there, and he's trying to get his family out. And, one thing about him is I don't quite – his motivation is like, the end of the world's coming, and he sends his family away, and he stays on the island. And somehow he's like, this is my site. This is ground zero. I can fix this. I think would have been better for me is that if he was the one who originally created – the tailored virus that eradicated cancer, not Emma Thompson. I never understand in his character why he decides it's his responsibility to fix everything. You know what I mean? Like, it's just something that's said, and I don't kind of buy it. If he was the one who created the cancer cure and then it went out of control, I would immediately buy it as like, okay, his sense of guilt is overwhelming that, he destroyed the world, and it's up to him now to want to cure the world. And maybe that's problematic in terms of the larger story. But I don't know. It's something that they did not solve here because I never quite figure out why he's so monomaniacally intent on staying and solving the problem at the risk of being with his family. So anyway, so we get it's great shots. I think they did film this in Manhattan. I remember I think I was living here at the time when they did this, and they were at South Street Seaport. They blocked it all off. They have these little devices that do retinal scans, and I guess if part of the virus manifests, it is shown retinally. So you get this great dramatic device where, if it's green, they pass. If it's red, they don't, and they can't leave. He is scanned positive. His child is scanned positive. And his wife is scanned. She's got the virus. And so there's this big dust-up, and he has to force them to scan her again. And at that point, it comes clear. And that's a little telltale to the film, too, that this all this stuff is being done so hastily that probably that the virus would not be contained on the island, that people got out who had it, and the machines were not foolproof, and so it probably got off the island at some point. What they don't go into is that did it just mutate on Manhattan Island, and was Manhattan Island ground zero? I mean, Neville keeps saying it is, but you're not told, was Dr. Crippen, did she live in New York? Was the measles cancer thing all in New York? And so that's all not told. I'm old school that way. Like, I like to know shit. Not everything. Like, you don't have to tell me everything, but I need to know a few things, just a few practical things to kind of just lock me into the film. So there's a very, very touching moment when he puts his wife and child on the helicopter. The daughter gives him back the dog because they can't take it. And he's, a tear pops down his eyes. He watches them leave, and it's really sad. And then the camera pans over to a group of Dark Seekers, got onto a helicopter, killed the pilot, and it's wildly out of control. It spins into the helicopter carrying his wife and child, and it kills them. So they're dead. I mean, it's over. And right then, the bridges are hit by the Air Force jets, and we see the explosion of the bridges, which is really, really well shot. So a very intense flashback scene. So now let's compare the actual zombies / vampires in these films. So in Richard Matheson's novel, there are... basically, there's two variations. We have the sort of the new, society, which has developed a drug to prevent the bacteria from turning them into sort of undead vampires. And that's going to be sort of the new, I guess that eventually will be, that drug will, maybe the children will have it, have a natural immunity to it, but that's going to be the new breed, the new civilization. The Spore actually brings people back to life, and those are kind of the brainless vampires that are attacking him at his house as well. And, in the novel, is not much. He doesn't really spend much time describing them. He's more interested in a sense, the story. In Last Man on Earth, very similar for Matheson, you have the you know, the people who have it, who are blocking it, and you have the undead who have gone all the way over. And they very much remind me of Romero zombies. You know, I feel like now that I've seen this film, I understand Romero's Night of the Living Dead a lot better. You know, they walk slow. They're not very bright. They can speak. And they do know his name. At least Ben Cortman knows his name. They call to him. And they use rudimentary sort of tools to attack the house. And they're dressed in, you know, what they wore when they were alive, which is now basically in tatters. In Omega Man, we have an interesting split. So the disease that has taken the family basically has completely turned them into albinos who are also scarred. So they have these very, very weird-looking eyes, and they all have to wear sunglasses. But it hasn't done anything to their brains. Like, they're not mindless. They're just, like, they're afflicted with this curse. And they've become zealots, right? They become kind of religious zealots who are against technology. So they're kind of more like a revolutionary faction than, you know, mindless vampires or zombies. They're just like a group that's been afflicted, and they believe that God has cursed them because of the war-making technology and tools that they've developed. So their whole MO now is to destroy the machines and start civilization back to, you know, basically the Dark Ages. And so they're dressed in these cloaks. Not very interesting, kind of goofy to look at as well, you know, not the greatest. There's a group of people who have been affected with the virus, but it hasn't manifested yet, and that's this other group that, I haven't gotten to that part in Omega Man yet, but they find him, and there may be a group of 10 or 15 of them, mostly children and youngsters, who have it, but it hasn't manifested yet, you know, so they're still kind of human, they're hiding out. If not treated, they'll all get it, and they're all going to kind of turn into the family. Also, you know, one weird thing is when you go over to the family, the virus, what we're told is the virus can manifest, you can have it for years and then one day wake up and you're an albino zombie, basically. But Lisa, who Heston's going to meet, you know, very shortly, when she turns, she also becomes a zealot. So there's this weird combination of, like, the virus is sort of connected to people worshiping Matthias immediately. And it's not very well explained. It's kind of dumb. I Am Legend, we're talking rabid wolves here. They're called Darkseekers. We're told that the plague has kind of mutated into a form of rabies, which keeps them alive at the same time, but they've turned into these incredibly tough creatures, and you know, their metabolisms are like twice that of human beings, and they can take an enormous amount of damage. We see them smashing open metal grates and, you know, using their bodies as missiles to kind of knock over cars and push stuff over. And it's, I have to say, as CGIs they may look, they're terrifying. And when they're around in the film in any way, you are like on edge. Like, you know, in the other films, you know, Heston can beat off, like, he can shoot him with a machine gun. In Last Man on Earth, you know, all Morgan needs is a mirror. But in this one, you know, we see Neville sometimes emptying entire clips at one Darkseeker, and it barely slows the bloody thing down. So they are terrifying. Now a brief just sort of overview of the thematic elements in each film. In the novel, basically, the theme is so much as kind of gimmick, is that we are seeing the birth of a boogeyman, and it comes at the end in kind of a nice flip where, from being the hero of the story, the end of the story leaves him that, from another perspective, he's actually a pretty terrifying and terrible figure to, like, a new civilization that's emerging. So very, very cool idea. It's not done to the same effect in any of the films. So Last Man on Earth, it's very similar, but they get into the vaccine and they can cure people, which is never done in the novel. The novel's never about, like, these people have a disease that has to be cured, and something about the hero is going to bring about that cure, but all of the films deal with a vaccine and a cure. So it's kind of interesting that that was kind of layered in from the get-go. In The Last Man on Earth, that you know, he is the last uninfected man, and that he does cure Lisa, who's the one. So it's possible that, you know, her blood now can contain a cure. That, so you don't really know. So it's kind of not done well, because you don't really know how, what's going to happen. But there's some chase at the end where he's like, I'm the last man, damn it, you know, and then he's killed. There's not much of a theme, really, that he's the last man. Like, so it's kind of muddled. And again, it's an American international picture. It's more of like a genre throwaway. So there wasn't really much for them to do, and they didn't really focus on it, I don't think. Omega Man actually has a theme, which is kind of cool, and you're tipped off to it by the Woodstock film, and it's very kind of like 60s peace movement stuff, in that the family, who are sort of the zombies in this film, very much are anti, you know, war, and with it, anti-technology. They want to burn the old world down because they feel like the march of civilization and technology, especially, is what brought about, first of all, the germ that killed everybody, and the second of all, that kind of destroyed the world, and that now they're taking it upon themselves to create a society that's free from technology and technical tools that created the civilization that came before. They kind of want to go backwards into medieval living. But there's also a theme where one of the kids that Neville meets up with later on realizes that Neville has a cure, and Neville sort of like, they're all animals and they should be exterminated. And the kid's kind of great. He's like, well, I don't know who's scarier, you or them, which is kind of cool. It's like they're both, and the kid is really kind of the novel one. And he, you know, goes to the family and says, hey, listen, I'm here on my own to see if there's a way we can, you know, we have a cure for everyone. And of course, the family believes that this affliction is God-given and that they shouldn't be cured, and that it's their affliction is kind of a guide for them to create a new society that's not based on the same ideas of the old. So they kill the kid, which is pretty kind of a sad moment. At the end of the film, you have Neville's blood being given to the survivors, and they're going to go out and create like a new civilization. And it's left up to you to say, you know, whether that civilization is going to just recreate the one that was destroyed, and they're going to have the same problems. And is this a cyclical thing? And, you know, what's going to happen years down the line when the family has set up a root civilization of their own, and the survivors of the plague who are immune are going to, they'll be dealing with technology, and what's going to happen? So there's kind of an idea here, which I kind of like. So in I Am Legend, it's a very, you know, it's a very artificial modern movie making theme, you know, because Neville didn't create the plague, his motivations for doing stuff are really muddled, so it doesn't quite work, but they tie in Neville with Bob Marley. So he listens to Bob Marley, his daughter was named Marley, he's always listening to Don't Worry About a Thing, so on and so forth, and so he has a brief monologue about that Bob Marley was shot. And 2 days later, he got back on his feet and did this concert. And there's this through line that says, the bad people in the world won't take a day off. How can I? Right. And so, you know, the theme here is that Neville, in his search for a cure, wants to bring a similar light to the world. Where Marley thought it could be cured with love and music, Neville's actually trying to bring about a cure by finding a vaccine and actually bringing this vaccine to the world to cure everyone. And like he says, to fix it all. And then there's some weird other thing that's thrown into the end of the film that doesn't quite work, because that's an interesting idea. But the woman who comes to eventually save him and find him is like, you know, I'm heading to some survivor's colony in Vermont. How did you know? How do you know it's there? God told me. And God told me to come here. And so she's kind of played as this, you know, very God-centered woman who's just like, you know, God talks to me and I listen. And because the world is quieter now, you just have to stop and listen and you can hear it. It's weird. It doesn't, I don't know, it's kind of like, it kind of resonates a little bit with the Marley stuff that, you know, she's kind of tapping into a little bit of that. But something about it didn't quite work. And then he flips over to her point of view too quickly, where there's some flashback about a butterfly. And I think she has a butterfly tattoo. And then he gives her the vaccine and that he realizes that, you know, maybe you're right. Maybe you're supposed to be here. And here's a vial of my blood, which contains the, you know, the cure for human beings and so on and so forth. The big thing in the 2007 film is that he's not unique. There are other people like him who are uninfected. So he's not so unique as a person. Yeah, he's unique in that he, at the end of the movie, you realize that he will go down as this, you know, hallowed figure. He will be quite legendary, as it were. But it's nothing like Matheson's original conception. And none of these films are. You know, none of these films, except the 1964 film, Hughes is the closest to it. Of the, like, he's going to be the boogeyman in the new civilization. But the Omega Man and I Am Legend are very much like, the hero is a hero and his blood's going to save humanity and bring us all back. So they adulterate the main story a little bit for their purposes. Just want to take a quick minute to let you know a couple of ways you can support Sci-Fi on Screen. One way is to use Patreon. Patreon is a crowdfunding site that works by allowing users to contribute on a show-by-show basis. All you do is choose a dollar amount you want to contribute, and every time one of my podcasts appears, you'll be debited the amount you choose. You can donate as little as $1 per show. That's $4 a month or $52 a year. No obligation, and you can cancel or adjust the rate at any time. And the best part is it keeps me honest. If there's no show, there's no charge. and it would help to defray hosting costs and for my time to put the shows together. The link is on my website, top right-hand corner, and signing up at Patreon is a snap by clicking on Become a Patron. There's also a great way as if you would like to buy the Blu-ray copies of any of the movies that I've reviewed on my podcast. Just simply go to the website, click on the movie page, and go ahead and click on the Blu-ray below the podcast, and it'll take you right to Amazon. If you purchase it, I get a few bucks from that as well. And I always appreciate it if you're on Twitter to retweet my podcast as they appear and spread the word. Okay, so now I just want to kind of recap then the remainder of the three films and what they do story-wise. We'll start with The Last Man on Earth. Basically, the film still follows Matheson's novel in that there's a dog involved. So he finds this dog. He does take him in. He perks up now because he kind of has a partner because he's been really, really alone. And that's something that really, really gave him a lot of joy. And of course, the dog, he can tell who's infected even if they're not showing signs by looking at their blood under a microscope. He comes to love the dog and then he waits as long as he possibly can, puts the dog's blood on the slide, finds out that it's infected, and it cracks him up. You know, which I think the 2007 movie plays with that idea as well, of this connecting with this animal to a degree that the loneliness is abated somewhat, and then when it's gone, you know, what happens to them after. So in 2007, he waits for the dog to turn before killing it. In this one, he just, you know, Morgan just stakes it and buries it the next day. And then we continue to track the novel where he sees a girl out and he's chasing her down. So there's this, you know, dramatic scene in the house. She recoils at the garlic. He's very suspicious of her. Thinks she's kind of like, you know, she still may be a zombie, but not quite as turned as the other ones. And she does shy away from the garlic, but explains it away that she's terrified. And in another room, he catches her injecting herself with something. And then he finds out that there's a group of them that haven't turned into vampires yet. And they use this drug to keep the thing at bay, so they're, you know, they're still somewhat human-like. They're infected, but they haven't turned. So the big twist here is that he transfuses his blood into hers and cures her. So she's kind of now on his side. She was sent there by this group of infected because he's been killing them as well as the other vampires. So like he's killing indiscriminately during the day, and they want him dead. So she's basically there to kind of lull him into complacency while they sort of gear up to attack him. But now she's conflicted because she realizes that, you know, what has happened to him and how he's reacted is not quite what they thought. But he cures her. She can now look into the mirror, spill garlic, and she wants to go back to her people and warn them that now, you know, they have a solution, that he's not a threat. And at some point, because he's distracted, he forgets to put garlic out into the door, and Ben, the zombie, breaks in and takes her away. And then her compatriots now attack, and they're killing everyone in sight. And she tries to intercede. She's completely ignored. He runs into a building. He kills them, and he finds an armory and smoke grenades and all kinds of stuff. And they basically chase him the steps of some church. He's wounded on the steps, and he's dying. He's like, "You freaks, I'm the last man." You know, and Ruth arrives to try to explain it. Of course, he dies. And so that ends that. In Omega Man, basically, we still see him, Mr. Heston's back out, you know, looking for the nest. That's the big thing, is he wants to find the nest now where the family holds up at night so he can eradicate them all. In a clothing store filled with mannequins, he hears a sound and he realizes that one of them is actually a human being. She's frozen, thinking that he'll like ignore her. So there's a chase, but she gets away and he thinks now that he's starting to hallucinate. And then there's an attack by the family that night in his wine cellar. They drop this huge rack on him and he's captured and basically taken to their location. He doesn't know where or how he got there. But so then him and Matthias have this back and forth, and we get to hear about the family's manifesto about them being anti-technology and so on and so forth. And we see their eyes for the first time. So then he's sort of chained to this cart and taken through the streets. And he's about to be burned alive in this arena. But all of a sudden, these lights come on, and he's saved by a woman named Lisa and Dutch, this young kid. He's rescued by them. They have this motorcycle, so there's like an action sequence. And it is the woman he saw earlier, so he realizes he's not crazy. So they've got all these incendiary grenades, and they keep the family back while Lisa and Neville can escape via motorcycle. The action's really bad. Like, it's just dated action. Like, you know, we're so sophisticated now that it's hard to... But the good thing is the film is so story-heavy that it doesn't rely on the action to wow you. So you can kind of be like, okay, there's an action sequence here, but the story is so strong, You know, whereas in modern movies, the stories are usually so weak that if the visuals and the cinematics aren't done really well, the film just dies. Where in films pre-Star Wars and Jaws, you had to have a strong story because you couldn't rely on effects and action sequences were not to the effect that they would blow away the viewer purely visually. So you had to have a strong story, which gives the older films kind of a little more structure. They take him to their little retreat up on a mountain. The kid Dutch is really smart. He studied Neville's biology work. He knows about the virus. He was in med school. And this young African-American kid is starting to turn into the virus. And so they take him back to Neville's place. And he realized that his blood must be the key. So he's developing the serum to try to save the kid's life. And at this point, a romance blossoms between Lisa and Neville. Ashley is the first on screen. I think Captain Kirk and Uhura was the actual first interracial kiss in any visual media. But in film, this is the very first interracial kiss in Chuck Heston and this woman. I think her name is Roseanne Cash. And they, they kiss and they go to it afterwards. So it's kind of cool. You know, there's this thing about the family. Now the family's coming in force. They really want to take Neville down. Zachary, the lieutenant, earlier had said to Matthias, hey, we can go to the armory and get all their machines and we can take him down. And Matthias is like, that's not our way, brother. You know, we'll do it our way. But now Zachary is sent alone to sort of sneak up on them and infiltrate, by himself. And we see that he's packing a pistol. So already, the family is all, there's already different factions that believe different things. So he forgets to prime the generators. So I think they go out. So Neville's got to climb down this elevator shaft to get to the garage, and Zachary climbs in. He sort of rappels his way up into the highest windows. Some really good tension here, actually. By the time Neville restarts the generators and comes back up, Lisa's there. Zachary's right behind her, and she ducks, and he kills Zachary with his machine gun, guns him down. You know, Neville winds up curing the boy with his blood. And at this point is when there's the conversation between the boy and Neville, where it's like, Neville's like, they're all animals, they should be exterminated, and the boy is like very much like, hey, maybe we can just make peace, maybe this doesn't have to happen. But he tells Neville where the nest is, and that was a big revelation, which is cool, because it's not just a us versus them movie. Like in this film, there's this theme of like, is there a possible way to drop all this crap. Basically, the plan now that Neville knows that the vaccine works, they're going to collect all the kids that he just met, and they're going to head into the mountains and kind of start a little, civilization on their own. And when he comes back, he finds out that the little kid that he cured went to Matthias on his own. And of course, Matthias kills him thinking he's a plant. So it comes to naught, just doesn't buy it at all. So now the family's out in force, they're walking towards Neville's place, and we see Lisa, and she's turned, and now one of them, which is really kooky because now she's like Matthias, so she's become a zealot somehow. When they get this, when they turn, they also become immediately aligned to Matthias and his group, which doesn't make any sense. But Neville's going the opposite direction, so by the time he gets to the courthouse, he sees that they've killed little Richie, which is a tough little scene, man, I gotta say. And now he's like adamant that he will exterminate them. But his car gets run off the road by the family on the way home, and he barely gets home. Lisa has turned, and she's now after him. Matthias is now there with him, and they tie him to a chair, and they destroy everything in his home while he's watching for James Bondian. They don't kill him right away. But he gets the jump on them. He grabs a bottle of the serum, and he holds Matthias at knife point, and everyone else backs away. He gets out of the house with Lisa, but out by the fountain, Matthias throws the spear and impales him fatally. So he dies, he's dying at this fountain. And the next morning, the whole group of kids who he was going to save have come by, and he's basically so far gone that he's dead. Neville gives Dutch the serum, and he dies, and it's very Christ-like. His arms are out, and like it's very pointed that he's this Messiah, whose blood will now save, the remnants of humanity. They also take Lisa with them because she doesn't go with the family, so I guess some part of her was still awake and aware, so she's a little conflicted. So, obviously, his blood is going to save them. So now let's skip to I Am Legend, the rest of the film of I Am Legend. There's some really terrific tension happening, and it's all part of one really good through line where he's out driving the next day, and he sees one of the mannequins that he's specifically placed around is in a different spot, and it's really creepy. And what happens is that he is caught in the same trap, the same type of trap that usually he uses to catch the Darkseekers. And so he's strung up, and he hits his head, and he wakes up when the sun's just about down. And so he cuts himself down, but in doing so, impales himself in the thigh with the knife, so he can't walk. So it's really intense. We see now that the leader of the Darkseekers is there with all these incredible zombie dogs. and he is crawling away, and the dogs are, there's like a bit of light coming from the sun that's kind of barring the way for the dogs, and they're just on the other side of this light beam, snarling, but if they stick their snouts in, they burn, so it, but the light is slowly fading and drawing to a very thin line, so like it's a really good tension. So they attack, and it's basically the dogs versus Neville and Sam. You know, they wind up killing them all, but Sam is bitten. It's a very tender scene at home. He shoots Samantha up with all these drugs that he can possibly shoot, but she turns immediately, and the camera pans up to his face as he's crying, and you know, he's choking the life out of her below, and it's a really, really tough scene. The next day, he buries the dog in Central Park. He goes to the video store, and he, you know, there was this female mannequin in one part of the store that he's like tried to approach and say hello to, but he's been shy. But he had promised the dog that he would do it, so he does it. And the loneliness is now completely crushing. So he's drunk, and he goes to the seaport at night to confront the zombies, and basically starts running them over with the car. But they're so powerful that you know, they take his truck out and flip it over. The leader of the Dark Seekers is about to basically chew him to pieces when these lights come on. You don't know where they're from. Now he's in and out of consciousness. He's in another truck, and this woman is driving, asking him where he lives. He tells her address. And then we wake up, and this is where, to me, where the best characterization in all the three movies happens, because now he wakes up after 3 years, and there's a woman in his kitchen cooking breakfast and a young boy sitting there eating like it's no big thing. You really see that, like, being alone for 3 years with only his dog has made it, he's so bizarre. You could see the filmmakers being like, oh my God, who are you? Thank God, I'm so lonely. But he's so freaked out that people are there. She's stitched up his leg, which he can see, and Shrek is playing on the television, and he's like mouthing the words. But so he enters the kitchen, and he sits down, and he's really freaked out, and he doesn't say anything, and they're really wary. At one point, he kind of loses it. His reason for it, it's like, I was saving that bacon, because she cooked some bacon. He's like, I was saving that. I was saving that. So he totally can't process it. She also tells him that there's a survivor's colony, and he's completely triggered by that. And he's like, there's no one else. Everyone else is dead. Everyone is dead. There's no survivor's colony. You don't know what you're talking about. So he has this whole reaction, and he leaves, goes upstairs. And then later he comes back, and he apologizes, and he's still really uneasy, though, which is great, because he should be, you know? And her story is that she was on a Red Cross ship out of Brazil, and there are other like her that are immune. There's a bunch of people that are immune. You know, that she's like, you know, come with us. There's a survivor's colony up in Vermont. And then we get this whole religious thing that she's like, you know, God sent me to find you, which I talked about earlier. But again, he's adamant that he's not going anywhere. This is my site. I can still fix this. This is ground zero, which doesn't kind of ring true, really. They go down to the lab, and we see this great wall of, he's taken a photograph of every Darkseeker he's tried to cure and failed. So that's kind of cool. We see that. And then he realizes that the Darkseekers now are converging on the house, because Anna didn't know about the sort of vinegar and covering the tracks. So now they know where he lives. He looks out the window, and there's a horde of them approaching the house. So he's got some sort of defenses. He sets off some explosions, kills a bunch of them. There are lights, but they're just so powerful, and they overwhelm the lights and they knock them out. And upstairs, he sees one of the metal shutters has been forced open. So one or more of them are in the house, which is really scary. And at one point now, this leader gets the best of Neville, you know, and it's chomping on his neck and throwing him around, and it's really scary. And finally, Neville finds a gun and like shoots at it, but it drives it off, doesn't kill it. Just incredibly ferocious. Just movie making at its best. Really, like, you're just riveted. And then he sneaks upstairs to find Anna and the boy, who they're not answering, and he realizes that one of them is tearing a hole in the ceiling of his house to let the others in. And it's really like there's a moment where they're really quiet. And Neville ultimately kills it, but before he does, it screams out an intense call, so the rest of them are coming. So they head down to the lab to hide. The woman who he tried to cure the following day, it didn't work, but he thought that if I can just maybe bring the body temperature down to a certain level, then inject it with the vaccine, maybe it'll help. And they find out that it's actually working. So he's found a vaccine to possibly cure this bloody thing. But the Darkseekers are now all in the place. So they're inside this little plexiglass box. You know, it's like bulletproof glass. And all the Darkseekers are on the other side. And they destroy the lab. The leader just keeps ramming his head into the wall and looking at Neville with this terrifying grin. Like, it's really scary. Neville basically, he pulls blood from the Darkseeker, realizing that this is now the cure, and he sticks the girl and the boy in this like metal hatch down in the basement, and he waits for the Darkseekers to smash through the glass, and then he sets off this incendiary grenade, which blows them all to pieces. And so he dies. And so at the end, we basically see Anna driving up in Vermont, and she comes to this walled city, and it is in fact a survivor's colony, and you know the camera tracks in on her handing the man the vial, and of course, you know, he is the legendary Neville and has cured it. So we've got the three films. We've got the novel. You know, in terms of just comparing the performances, I think Price is probably the weakest of the three. Later in the movie, when he has to interact, you know, with other people, like he gets overwrought too quickly, and he's just kind of like really, really not very good. Like he's great in the first half when he's just kind of, you feel sorry for him and he's just sad, but near the end of the film, like he's not very good. Heston is terrific, you know, very tired and world weary, always, to me, always commands whatever movie he's in, and very good up to the end. Like even, you know, when he tells the boy like they should be exterminated, like he's just a very commanding presence. Heston's never like revelatory, but he's rarely bad, you know, like he has just a certain set of tools that he uses in every film that just always make him, to me, very watchable and always can anchor a movie with his presence. He's a big guy, too. So, you know, he's just there on the screen. So he's, to me, he's really good. I think for this story, because every movie and the novel pretty much revolves around a lone man on screen for a long time. And that, you know, Heston definitely pulls it off without doubt. Will Smith is great. And I would say Smith is probably the best here because more that they do more with the character than the other ones. He's very vulnerable at certain times. He cries a lot, you know, like he suffers the pangs of emotional regret. He gets angry and he can be kind of dangerous looking. He's very competent. Then there's a really weird scene when, you know, the girl and the young boy come to visit him. It's really terrific. Although the motivation for his character, the other two characters are stuck. They have no way out really. And they're doing what they're doing because there's no other option. But you know, at one point when Smith is like offered a way out and he doesn't take it, you're just like, it doesn't ring true, you know. The directorial style of the three films, I would say that Last Man on Earth is very much an artifact of its time. It takes its time. I think its pacing is great. Really good vistas of the city, very stark in the black and white. We spend a good deal of time with Morgan, getting to know him and relate to what's going on. The zombies and the action sequences are unfortunately absurdly dated, and the music is not very good. Omega Man is kind of similar. The Lonely City is rendered really well, and we spent a lot of good character development time with Neville, which is great, getting us into his head. The vampires are terrible. I mean, the family and their black cloaks are really, really cheesy. So it really kind of detracts from the film. And the action sequences also are very dated. You know, that can't be helped. You know, there are some stunts of guys on fire and people launching into the air, but nothing much. Here's where I Am Legend shines because, you know, it has the benefit of, like I was talking about earlier, just all these techniques that are to be used now, sound as well as visual. And we're really in this world. I mean, the world of New York City, post-apocalyptic, is so lived in. Between his apartment and when he's out on the streets and how we see the world, it's incredible. It's not just, you know, we filmed early in the morning kind of stuff, you know? And the Darkseekers here, I mean, to my mind, they work because they create real terror in the film. He's not using mirrors or garlic to, you know, fend off the Darkseekers. Like, these bloody things are terrifying and powerful. Whenever they're close or in any kind of sequence in this film, you're grabbing the sides of your seat. So, and Francis Lawrence just has a wonderful way with the camera. It's just some really elegant shots. He uses, you know, he has the benefit of Steadicam, which the other two films did not. So we get that steady cam tension when he uses it. He also can do big vistas. It's a great scene when Will Smith is playing golf on a SR-71 Blackbird on the Intrepid, which is just really neat. So yeah, so I mean, cinematically, you can't compare, but it's not better or worse. It's just a product of its time, you know? So yeah, so that's a comparison of the three films. Kind of interesting to just think about the novel that spawned them and all these ideas that came out of it. Really enjoyed just kind of doing back and forth. And I would recommend checking out the novel if you're interested, just because it's always fun to go back to the original source of things. I would say the same to read Who Goes There, the short story by John Campbell, for The Thing from Another World and The Thing as well. It just was interesting for me to kind of check out Matheson and then compare the three films. So hope you enjoyed my take on the I Am Legend franchise, and I'll see you next time. Thanks once again for listening to Sci-Fi on Screen, to my returning listeners and new listeners alike. If you like what you heard, head on over to iTunes and give us a review. We'd love to hear from you. If you have any suggestions about the show, you can send an email to scifionscreen@gmail.com, or feel free to leave a comment on the website, www.scifionscreen.com, and you can leave a comment in the comments section of the show page. If you'd like to support scifionscreen.com, you can go to patreon.com/scifionscreen, and that's Patreon is P-A-T-R-E-O-N. And to make it easy on yourself, there is a button on the webpage that you can click. Patreon is set up so you can pick an amount you want to contribute per episode, and it'll be recurring. If you'd like to do that, that is available. We'd appreciate all the support we can get. And you can find us, again, our website, www.scifionscreen.com. We have a Facebook page, and on any smartphone, you could search for us on the podcast app and subscribe. Thanks again. See you next time.